Now I can distinctly hear a harpsichord approaching, so it must be time for some period drama. Henry Fielding's comic adventure takes the foundling Tom Jones to the sinful big city, and a feast for the senses.
Tom Jones by Henry Fielding, dramatised by Stephen Wyatt. Part 3.
And so our hero and the faithful Partridge arrive in London. Tom has often heard Mr. Allworthy mention a respectable widow at whose house he used to stay when he was in town, and so it is to this Mrs. Miller that they apply for lodging.
I don't wish to impose upon your kindness.
No, no. You're more than welcome, Mr. Jones. Stay here as long as you wish. I owe Mr. Allworthy a great deal. He helped me out most generously when my husband died.
But you do understand that I no longer possess Mr. Allworthy's support and approval. He has turned me out of doors.
In these matters, I trust my own instincts. I believe you're an honest young man, and your falling out with him is only temporary.
I wish I could believe you. I was planning to enlist, but, well, since what happened with Miss Sophia Weston, I feel I had to come to London and find her. You see, she left her muff behind at the inn in Upton. I ought to return it, but I don't know where to start.
Oh, Mrs. Fitzpatrick.
I don't follow.
I was trying to remember her name. She is Miss Weston's cousin Harriet. Perhaps the young lady's staying with her.
Do you know Mrs. Fitzpatrick's address?
Indeed, I do.
And so our hero pays a call upon Mrs. Fitzpatrick, who receives him warmly, but gives little away about the whereabouts of Sophia. However, once he has departed, she hurries off to report it all to her other cousin, Lady Bellaston, the great lady with whom Sophia is staying.
He is a very fine figure of a young man.
So I have heard. My dear Mrs. Fitzpatrick, you have behaved admirably in seeking my advice. I shall be very glad to play my part in the preservation of a virtuous young lady from a temptation which is clearly even more tempting than I had imagined. We must therefore make it our business to keep Sophia from seeing this dangerous young fellow.
He will stop at nothing to get at her.
Yes. I suppose he might get some intelligence about where she is and then lurk about my house. So it would be useful if I knew what he looked like. Is there no way, madam, by which I could have a sight of him?
He has threatened me with another visit this afternoon. So if your ladyship please to do me the honour of calling upon me then, say, between 4 and 5.
Perfect. I will be there. Ah. And how is your dear Irish peer? Is he attentive?
He is a model of courtesy.
And I trust discretion. No word then recently of dear Mr. Fitzpatrick?
He does not know where I am. I suspect he no longer cares.
Let us certainly hope so.
It's good of you to see me again, Mrs. Fitzpatrick.
Oh, not at all. I only wish I knew more of dear Sophia's whereabouts. But I am still making inquiries on your behalf.
I'm most grateful. There is also the matter of this muff, which I must return to its rightful owner.
Lady Bellaston!
My dear Mrs. Fitzpatrick, forgive me for arriving unannounced.
I don't believe you've met Mr. Jones?
No, I don't believe I have.
I don't want to take any more of your time, Mrs. Fitzpatrick.
If you leave word with my servants where you are lodged, I will let you know as soon as I discover any further information.
Your servant, ma'am. Your servant, your ladyship.
Well?
Well, he is certainly handsome. But I am satisfied on Sophia's account. She is in no danger from this fellow.
That night, Mr. Jones receives a mysterious bundle.
It was delivered by a porter.
I'm mystified.
He was very specific that it was for you, Mr. Jones.
Who can have sent this?
Festina Lente. Let's discover what's in there first.
A domino.
A mask.
And a masquerade ticket.
There must be some mistake.
It looks to me like some young lady thinks highly of you.
Wait. There's a card in the sleeve of the domino. To Mr. Jones, the Queen of the Fairies sends you this. Use her favours not amiss.
But there's only one lady who knows my address in London, and that's Mrs. Fitzpatrick. Perhaps she has some news of Sophia after all.
Perhaps.
Well, there's nothing to be lost by finding out.
Picture now the scene. Lanterns throw light upon brightly dressed revellers who laugh and drink and flirt, all behind the safety of the mask which licenses their mirth. But Tom has to find the benefactress who has sent him his ticket. It is not long before he finds himself engaged in conversation with a buxom shepherdess, albeit a shepherdess who has probably never seen a sheep in her life.
Do I know you?
I don't think so, sir. But you're more than welcome to get to know me.
If you talk any longer with that trollop, I shall acquaint Miss Weston.
The elegantly dressed mask who has just spoken starts to walk away.
Madam, please! Please! Come back! Who are you?
I had imagined that Mr. Jones had been a more discerning lover than to suffer any disguise to conceal his mistress from him.
So tell me, madam, is she here?
Hush, sir! You will be observed, I promise you. Upon my honour, Miss Weston is not here.
So, tell me, please, how may I find her? My good fairy queen, I know your majesty very well. Indeed, Mrs. Fitzpatrick, it's cruel to divert yourself at the expense of my torments.
Though you have so ingeniously discovered me, I must still speak in the same voice, lest I should be known by others.
Perhaps a less naive young man would have recognised the voice of Lady Bellaston, but recollect Tom has barely heard it.
So, do you think, good sir, that I have no greater regard for my cousin than to assist in carrying on an affair between the two of you, which must end in her ruin as well as your own?
Alas, madam, you know little of my heart if you think I would contribute to her ruin.
I'm glad to hear it. But I would still have you ambitious for yourself. Perhaps you may succeed with those who are infinitely superior in fortune to my cousin. I am convinced there are women. But don't you think me a strange creature, Mr. Jones, to be thus giving advice to a man with whom I am so little acquainted?
Madam, I...
And are you so little versed in our sex to imagine you can entertain a lady with your passion for another woman? If the fairy queen had conceived no better opinion of your gallantry, she would scarce have appointed you to meet her at a masquerade.
Forgive me, madam. I did not mean to be ungallant.
Then, shall we walk? You cannot conceive anything more insipid and childish than a masquerade to the people of fashion, who in general know one another as well here as when they meet in a drawing room. Oh, we come here to kill time and generally leave more exhausted than from the longest sermon. I confess, it would be almost charity in me to spare you the tedium and go home for your sake.
I know but one charity equal to it, and that is to suffer me to wait on you at home.
Sure, you must have a very strange opinion of me, that upon such an acquaintance I would let you into my doors at this time of night. I fancy you impute the friendship I have shown my cousin to some other motive.
Madam, I didn't mean to suggest.
Confess honestly now. Don't you consider this contrived interview as little better than a downright assignation? Are you used, Mr. Jones, to make these sudden conquests?
As you have taken my heart by surprise, the rest of my body has a right to follow. So you must pardon me if I resolve to attend you wherever you go.
Oh, you mustn't do that. I am going to visit a friend in my carriage. On no account must you accompany me. You have disobeyed me.
You did not forbid me to enter.
It would have been uncivil of me. But what will the world think of you being here alone with me in a carriage?
Why should the world know?
And now I come to think of it, I had forgotten my friend was away tonight. So, what happens if we arrive at her house and spend time there, alone, together.
Shall I tell you what I think?
What is that?
I think you should unveil your mask, Mrs. Fitzpatrick.
I thought you would never ask.
But you're...
Indeed, Mr. Jones. I am Lady Bellaston. And here we are at my friend's house in Hanover Square. I positively forbid you to follow me inside. Mr. Jones.
It is not our intention to give any account of the ensuing conversation, which lasts from 2 till 6 o'clock in the morning. It is believed that Lady Bellaston promises help in finding Sophia. The rest we respectfully leave once again to your imagination. A second evening meeting at the same place for another day is arranged, and then Lady Bellaston returns to her own house and Mr. Jones to his lodgings.
Good morning, Master.
Good morning. I'm the bringer of good tidings.
A banknote for £50?
Go and get it changed at once.
But
don't ask.
And indeed, if it is not stolen, we can only conclude it comes from Lady Bellaston, who, though she does not give much to such hackneyed charities as building hospitals and schools, is not entirely void of Christian charity, where a young fellow of merit without a shilling in the world is concerned.
Indeed, Mr. Jones, the garments fit you exceedingly well.
I am not accustomed to being so grandly dressed.
The man should always look well in his clothes, as indeed he should without his clothes.
My lady, you have promised me on many occasions to help me find my Sophia.
I do not wish to hear that girl's name.
But you know where she is.
Cannot imagine what gave you that idea.
I have offended you.
Clothes make the man. And I, as it were, make the clothes.
The fact is that our hero is in something of a dilemma. Lady Bellaston is a very generous and, for her years, very attractive patroness. But she is not Sophia and he is not in love with her. Who knows how long his predicament would have continued had it not been for a note from Lady Bellaston.
My dear Mr. Jones, our usual place is no longer convenient,
and I am now resolved to see you this evening at my own house, whatever may be the consequence. Come to me exactly at 7. I dine abroad, but will be at home by that time. If you should accidentally be a few minutes before me,
bid them show you into the drawing room.
So why has Lady Bellaston made such an imprudent change in her plans? Because on the night in question, Lady Bellaston has proposed to Sophia that she might like to attend the new play, and Sophia has happily accepted. So it looks as if Lady Bellaston has Tom to herself for the evening.
This way, Mr. Jones.
Miss Weston.
Mr. Jones.
To think that if only there had not been a riot in the theatre over the merits of the new play, Sophia wouldn't have been at home.
I see you are surprised.
Surprised? I almost doubt whether you are the person you seem.
Oh, Sophia, if you knew how much I have suffered in this long, fruitless pursuit.
Pursuit of whom?
How can you be so cruel as to ask that question?
I think I have every right. After all that has happened.
But I still hold your muff. I have kept it close to my heart. Here it is. I have to ask your pardon.
My pardon? After all that took place?
You are right. If any remembrance of me ever disturbs you, then let the remembrance of what you learned at the inn at Upton blot me forever from your mind.
Is there any good reason why it shouldn't?
Believe me. You cannot hate or despise me more for what happened there than I do myself. But yet do me the justice to think that my heart was never unfaithful to you.
That is easily said.
But it's true. I've accepted all along I can never marry you.
You are right to do so. Although my father knows I will never marry where my heart is not engaged.
So Mr. Blifil.
I will never marry him. Even though that means I can never marry anyone.
This is so cruel.
I was upset when I knew you were unfaithful to my memory. But what right have I to ask you to remain true when I cannot offer you my hand, however much...
However much?
I have said enough.
I will never forget my love for you, Sophia. Even though it will be in silence and at a distance from you in some foreign land, no sigh of my despair shall ever reach and disturb your ears. And when I am dead...
No more, please. This is cruel.
Let me kiss those tears away.
Tom, no. Tom.
What is it?
I don't understand. How you come to be here, in Lady Bellaston's house. And you are so smartly dressed.
Well, it's just that...
Why? Miss Weston? I thought you had been at the play.
The theatre was unruly. I came home early.
I should not have broken in upon you if I had known you had company. Won't you introduce me?
Oh, this is Mr. Jones, madam.
Mr. Jones, how do you do?
I am pleased to make your acquaintance, your ladyship. The fact is...
Yes?
I had this muff to return to Miss Weston, which I found by chance, and I was fortunate enough to meet somebody to masquerade who indicated that this is where Miss Weston lived, and so I've been able to return it to her.
Fortunate indeed.
I am very grateful to Mr. Jones for the trouble he has taken.
Maybe he should be rewarded.
I seek only the honour of being allowed to pay another visit here.
Sir, my doors are never shut to people of fashion.
Thank you, my lady. Goodbye, Miss Weston.
Goodbye, Mr. Jones.
Upon my word, a good, pretty young fellow. Though I don't remember ever to have seen his face before. I hope I did not embarrass you by entering as I did.
Oh, not at all. Mr. Jones and I have long acknowledged that there can be nothing between us. He came purely because of the muff.
Of course, my dear. But why was he so insistent about returning here?
I fancy your ladyship has as good an idea of why that may be as I do.
Unfortunately, under all the smiles, Lady Bellaston conceals much indignation against Sophia, who stands between her and the full indulgence of her desires. And it is not long before a very favourable opportunity of getting rid of her presents itself, through the agency of a young nobleman called Lord Fellamar.
So, who is she?
To whom are you referring?
This blazing star of beauty you have released upon us all of a sudden.
Why, my lord, that blazing star is the daughter of a country booby squire.
I never saw anyone so genteel, so elegant, so ravishingly beautiful.
My cousin has you, I find.
I wish she had, for I'm in love with her to distraction. Will you do me the honour of proposing marriage to her father?
Are you really, then, in earnest?
I do not jest in matters of this kind.
Alas, my lord, you have a rival. And a rival, though I blush to name him, neither you nor all the rest of the world will be able to conquer.
You have struck a damp in my heart.
I rather hoped I had struck fire into you, for he is a beggar, a foundling, a fellow in meaner circumstances than one of your lordship's footmen.
A creature of such perfections thinks of bestowing herself unworthily.
Alas, my lord, the bane of all young women is the country. There they learn the most ridiculous, romantic notions of love.
But she cannot throw herself away upon such trash. Have you attempted to reason with her?
My dear lord, surely you know better than to talk of reasoning a young girl, particularly a country girl, out of her inclinations. Time is the only medicine to cure her folly. But it is a medicine which I am certain she will not take. I live in hourly horrors on her account. In short, nothing but violent means will do.
Whatever do you mean?
I mean that if your lordship really has this attachment to my cousin, I think there may be one way, although it is a very disagreeable one, and one I am almost afraid to think of.
I have some apprehension of what your ladyship means.
But in the meantime, we should not despair. Dine here. Dine here often. Your lordship will see for yourself the state of her inclinations.
My lady, there is something I must say.
Say what you will, my dear. We are alone.
It is about Lord Fellamar.
What about him?
I would be most grateful if you would not encourage his visits.
But why not? He is a man of the highest breeding.
That may be. But yesterday morning he made downright love to me. I beg your ladyship never to leave us alone again. And if he inquires for me, your servants will tell him that I am not here.
My dear child, I do believe you country girls have nothing but sweethearts in your head. You fancy every man who is civil to you is making love to you. And indeed, I wish with all my heart he was, for you would be an arrant madwoman to refuse him.
Then I am that madwoman.
Of course, my dear. Whatever you wish.
Really, she is adorable, but I don't wish to...
My lord, surely you are not frightened by the word rape. I fancy quite a few of my married acquaintance were ravished before the knot was tied.
Well, I...
May I pour you some more wine?
Oh, thank you. She is an angel.
Indeed. And a woman with 80,000 pounds in dowry doesn't stand in need of an advocate to recommend her.
Miss Weston only needs the recommendation of her charms.
She is the most delicious girl, that's certain.
So where is she?
She is in the drawing room below. I hate to think of her being in the arms of someone who does not deserve her.
Then I shall visit her this very moment.
Within a week, I'm convinced I shall call your lordship my cousin in public.
It is 7. Poor Sophia, alone and melancholy, sits reading a tragedy entitled The Fatal Marriage. I refrain from further comment.
Ah. I am afraid, Miss Weston, I break in upon you abruptly.
I own myself surprised at this unexpected visit.
I hope you will pardon the effects of a frenzy which you yourself have occasioned. Love for you has so totally deprived me of reason that I am scarcely accountable for any of my actions.
My lord, I understand neither your words nor your behaviour.
I dote upon you to the highest degree of distraction.
I shall not stay to hear any more of this.
No, but you must. Pardon me, my beloved angel. I cannot lose you. I would sooner part with my soul.
Let go of my hand, my lord. I wish to leave and never see you more.
Then I must make best use of this moment, for I cannot live, nor will I live without you.
Oh.
Her cries might have fallen unheeded, as Lady Bellaston has taken care to remove all ears. But fortunately for Sophia, in the rooms below, another noise now breaks forth, which almost drowns her cries.
Where is she? I must all... Damn me, Ireland! No. Come. Come. Show me her chamber, I say. Oh. Show me where she is. Ah, there you are, you ungrateful bitch.
Father.
Sir, I...
Hold your tongue, you pathetic coxcomb.
Sir, I protest.
Oh, do you now?
You hit me. I'm a peer of the realm.
I'll hit you again if you interfere between me and my daughter.
Your daughter?
Father, you are drunk.
Damn me, Sophie, you look almost pleased to see me.
But how did you know I was here?
Your cousin Harriet showed more damned sense than she's ever shown before. Though pox are now getting back into the family's affections. Now, girl, come with me.
Cousin Weston, what is the cause of all this noise?
There you are, your ladyship. Before you stands the most undutiful child in the world. I'll wager she never told you she hankers after a beggarly rascal and won't marry one of the greatest matches in England.
You do her wrong. I am convinced that she will not refuse a match which is so much to her advantage.
This is a willful mistake by Lady Bellaston. She knows the squire refers to Mr. Blifil, but chooses to leave open the possibility that he might instead be reconciled to Lord Fellamar's proposals.
Do you hear what your cousin says, Sophie? Now, come on. Make your father happy.
If my death will make you happy, sir, you will shortly be so.
That's a damn lie. Now be a good girl and give your consent before your cousin.
Indeed, it is very much the fashion nowadays to dispense with time and long courtship.
Who needs courtships before marriage? People make court very well after they've been a bed together.
Well, sir, no hard feelings. Although I am not known to you personally, I am delighted to learn that my proposals are being treated with favour.
So, who the devil are you, sir?
I am Lord Fellamar, and I hope to be the happy man who will become your son-in-law.
You? My son-in-law be damned to you. You are a son of a bitch for all your laced coat.
I am not used to take such language from any man, sir. But since it is you, I will bear no resentment.
Resentment, my arse! I'll teach you to father-in-law me. I'll lick your jack.
No,
cousin, please.
My daughter shall have an honest country gentleman. I have pitched upon one for her, and she shall have him. I'm sorry for the trouble Sophie has caused, your ladyship, as she comes along with me.
Oh, father!
What?
I will come without force. Your ladyship, I apologise for
any... come along, Sophie! I'm never letting you out of my sight again till you are married. Farewell, my lady!
And to be honest, Lady Bellaston is not a little pleased with the confinement into which Sophia is going.
Your health, Partridge.
I've been asking round, and I'm afraid there's no doubt you're not the first young fellow Lady Bellaston has debauched.
But I'm still so entangled with her that I don't know how to extricate myself. Besides, without her, we would even be wanting for a scrap of bread. I can't desert her. And yet if I don't, I'm guilty of the blackest treachery to one who deserves infinitely better of me than my lady.
Well, I think I have found a solution which can't fail. Propose marriage to her.
Are you mad?
No, I venture hanging on the success. Propose marriage and she will declare off in a moment. I heard of a young fellow she kept formerly who tried it, and she backed off immediately.
Well, I only hope you're right. Dear Lady Bellaston, permit me to say that, as your honour is as dear to me as my own, so my sole ambition is to have the glory of laying my liberty at your feet.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me when I assure you I can never be made completely happy until you generously bestow on me a legal right of calling you mine forever.
That's good.
I am, madam, your ladyship's most obedient humble servant, Thomas Jones.
Perfect. Up to me. I'll deliver it at once.
Sir, do you really imagine me a fool? Or do you fancy yourself capable of so entirely persuading me out of my senses that I should deliver my whole fortune into your power in order to support your pleasure at my expense? If you come here,
I shall not be at home. Partridge, you are a genius.
One further matter, sir.
What's that?
Miss Weston has left Lady Bellaston's. Her father has taken her away to somewhere in Piccadilly. The squire's sister has taken charge of things.
I must thank you once again, Aunt, for gaining me my liberty from my chamber.
My brother is a barbarian. I have told him again and again that women in a free country are not to be treated with such arbitrary power. We are as free as the men, and I heartily wish I could not say we deserve that freedom better. All the same, Sophia, I do have a bone to pick with you. While I understand your reluctance to marry Mr. Blifil, I am amazed at your refusal of Lord Fellamar. Have you no sense of ambition? I simply cannot understand where you have got your grovelling nature from. For myself, I will never suffer the world to see that I encouraged you in refusing one of the best matches in all England.
The blame I accept is entirely my own.
That is no consolation. I only hope you will not follow the example of your cousin Harriet.
Who told you where I was?
Hoping to curry favour, no doubt. But your father had scarcely left when that impudent fellow with the odious name Fitzpatrick broke in upon me with a long, unintelligible story about his wife. So I gave him Harriet's letter and told him to make what sense of it he could.
But, Aunt...
She married badly, and she must take the consequences. But you have on offer a magnificent marriage to a family which in title has the advantage of our own.
But in your own case, from your own account, you have had many lovers.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say.
You refused them all. And I am convinced there was at least one coronet among them.
You say true, dear Sophia. I did have the offer of a title.
Why, then, will you not allow me to refuse this one?
Well, mine was not so good an offer as yours. That is, not so very... very good an offer.
But it was not the first, nor the second, nor the third advantageous proposal you had received.
I own it was not.
So perhaps I too will get a second better offer than this. I am a very young woman, and surely I need not despair.
Sophie, what would you have me say? You know I love you and can deny you nothing. I have not always been so easy. I have formerly been thought cruel. By the men, I mean. I was called the cruel Parthenissa. Of course, I was never as handsome as you. And yet I had something of you. I am, I confess, a little altered now.
So you will not support my father in forcing me into marriage?
Sophia, there is something else I should tell you. It's about Mr. Jones. He had the impertinence to make an offer of marriage to Lady Bellaston. She showed me the letter herself.
I cannot believe...
Oh, you shall see it too. I'll make sure of that.
Our hero, meanwhile, decides to return to his only other contact, Sophia's cousin, Mrs. Fitzpatrick. Her attitude has changed somewhat since her aunt and uncle rejected her overtures. Of her current closeness to the Irish peer, we have no definite information.
Mr. Jones, I pity you. I know my cousin better than you, and I must say, any woman who makes no return to such a passion and such a person as yours is unworthy of both.
Sure, madam, you can't
mean... There is something, I think, in true tenderness like yours which is... bewitching? Surely she must be the most contemptible of women who can overlook... such merit.
Madam...
Mr. Jones suddenly knows it is time to go.
I fear, madam, I have paid too tiresome a visit. I should take my leave.
If you must, but rest assured I will continue to make inquiries on your behalf, so let me see you again as soon as you can. Tomorrow, if you will. I shall be at home. All day.
Thank you, madam, thank you. I take my humble leave.
The alert listener will probably guess who, primed by the letter from Miss Weston, is in the street outside. In fact, Mr. Fitzpatrick has just located his wife's address when our hero emerges from the house.
Excuse me, sir.
What is it?
Might I ask what you have been doing in that house?
I have been visiting the lady there.
And what business have you with the lady?
Don't you recognise me?
Can't say that I know your name or your face.
We met at the inn in Upton. Where you were looking for your wife, and where you intruded upon me and a lady, and... well, it was a foolish quarrel, and if it is not yet made up, let's now make it up over a bottle.
At Upton, of course! Your name is Jones?
Indeed it is.
Upon my soul, you are the very man I wanted to meet. We'll have a bottle presently, but first we must deal with your behaviour towards my wife. So now I'm going to give you a great knock over the pate! Upon my soul, if you don't give me satisfaction for that blow, I will give you another!
Now, Tom knows nothing of fencing, but thanks to Lady Bellaston, he does carry a sword. And faced with an angry Irishman who has insulted him and has his sword out, he sees little choice. Tom presses in so boldly upon Fitzpatrick that he beats down his guard and sheathes half of his sword in the body of the said gentleman.
I have satisfaction enough. I am a dead man.
I hope not, sir. I didn't choose this duel. Sir!
He's killed him. He ran him through. Call for an officer.
Officer!
And so our hero is brought before the justice.
You have heard from the surgeon. He believes the wound to be mortal.
I am deeply sorry for what I have done. I hate to shed blood, but I do not believe I am guilty of murder.
That is not for you to decide. Take him to the gatehouse.
Oh, your feet, you. This way.
And so Tom is led away to prison, where the faithful Partridge finds him the next morning. He brings with him a letter which compounds Tom's misery.
It's from Sophia. Oh. Her aunt has shown her my proposal of marriage to Lady Bellaston. She desires never to hear my name again. There is nothing left to hope for.
Not long after, a carriage brings to town two principal characters in our story who have not made an appearance for some time. Mr. Allworthy and his nephew, Mr. Blifil.
Well, Mr. Allworthy, the hounds have changed at last, and when we imagined we had a fox to deal with, God rat it, it turns out to be a badger.
Pray, good neighbour, drop your metaphors and speak a little plainer.
Why then, to tell you straight, we have all this time been afraid of a son of a whore of a bastard of somebody's, and now here's a confounded son of a whore of a lord, who may be a bastard too, for what I know or care, but he shall never have a daughter of mine by my consent. She's still all yours, Mr. Blifil. Neighbours should look after one another.
I am most grateful, Mr. Weston.
All the same, nephew, we must consider carefully. When this match was proposed, I embraced it very readily from my regard to you both. To my eyes, Sophia has always been an obedient daughter. So, if she fled from this match, we have to ask why. To force a woman into a marriage contrary to her consent or approbation is an act of such injustice and oppression that I wish the laws of our country could restrain it.
Am I not her father? Did I not beget her?
Neighbour, please. Now, sadly, it is clear to me that the inclinations of this young lady are most unhappily averse to my nephew. I must therefore decline any further thoughts of the honour you intended him.
Decline? Am I not to govern my own dear child and decide what is best for the ungrateful bitch?
You will not change my mind.
Uncle, if I might speak.
Of course.
I am sure I would never consent to any violence being used upon the lady to bring about her consent. My conscience will not permit me to use violence on anyone, much less on a lady for whom, however cruel she is to me, I shall always preserve the purest and sincerest affection.
Oh, nobly said, nephew.
However, I have read that women are seldom proof against perseverance. Why, then, may I not hope in time to gain her hand? Mr. Weston is kind enough to prefer me to this lord.
He may go to hell for all I care.
But then, I fear that the basest and wickedest of men, Mr. Jones, I mean, still holds her heart.
Our good Mrs. Miller was most eloquent in his praise when we saw her just now. It made me sad to think how we must remain unreconciled.
Then, Uncle, perhaps you have not heard. Mr. Jones has committed a murder and is in prison. Even if the law should spare his life, will not suffice.
What's this? Has he committed a murder? Is there any hope of seeing him hang?
I had no idea.
Well, 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 then no forcing of Sophie shall be attempted just now. After all, if this fellow be hanged and out of the way, then who knows? Come, gentlemen, and dine with me. I have bespoke a shoulder of mutton roasted and a spare rib of pork and a fowl and egg sauce. Mr. Blifil?
I shall be honoured, sir.
Mr. Allworthy?
You must excuse me. I'm not hungry. I shall return to my lodgings.
What news, Partridge?
Well, it seems the only witnesses who saw the beginning of your unfortunate encounter with Mr. Fitzpatrick were a crew belonging to a man of war which then lay at Deptford. So I went off to Deptford.
And?
I was told the men I sought after were all gone ashore. So I've been searching for them from tavern to tavern.
No luck?
None.
And Mr. Fitzpatrick? I suppose the poor gentleman is dead?
Not when I inquired this morning. But I will not give you false hopes. The word is that his wound is mortal.
Then it's all hopeless.
A lady asking to see you, sir.
A lady? What name?
You'll have to ask her yourself, sir.
Best if I wait in the outside room.
So Partridge withdraws, and Tom waits anxiously for his guest, who turns out to be...
Mrs. Waters?
I don't wonder at your surprise, Mr. Jones. I believe few gentlemen in here are troubled with any visits from a lady, unless, of course, it be a wife. Indeed, I little thought when we parted at Upton after that memorable night that our next meeting would be in such a place.
It's very kind of you to visit me under such dismal circumstances.
Oh, I do protest, Mr. Jones. Your face is more miserable than any dungeon in the universe. What can be the matter with you?
I thought you knew the cause, madam.
You pinked a man in a duel, that's all.
I believe I have killed him.
Well, since you take it so much to heart, I will relieve you. The first surgeon was a young, ignorant fellow who feared the worst. But there's a more experienced surgeon attending him now who apprehends not the least danger of life.
If only that were true. How can you know?
Well, I first encountered Mr. Fitzpatrick at Upton, and now, by the most extraordinary accident in the world, I lodge in the same house as he does. I promise you he does you justice and says, whatever the consequence, he was entirely the aggressor and you were not in the least to blame.
Madam... God bless you. You give me new hope. Believe me, I have spent many dark, wakeful hours here, and I have resolved never to sin more, lest I bring something worse upon myself.
Oh, I'm sure once you're at liberty, you'll be as lively as ever. Goodbye for now, Mr. Jones.
Our hero's relief may be imagined, but fate, it seems, has decided to keep matters distinctly tragical.
Partridge, what's the matter? You look terrible.
I'm sorry, sir. So very sorry. I couldn't help hearing. But I'd rather have been 100 miles away than to have heard what I've heard.
Why? I don't understand.
Was that woman who was just gone out the woman who was with you at Upton?
She was, Partridge.
You know fate dictated that I never saw her there. Only now. But did you really, sir, go to bed with that woman?
I'm afraid what passed between us is no secret.
Then God have mercy upon your soul.
What do you mean?
As sure as I stand here alive, you have been abed with your own mother.
It cannot be true.
I'm speaking the truth. That is Jenny Jones, your mother. She left the village about the same time as I did. They claimed I was your father, which I'm not. But there was no doubt she is your mother.
I don't know what to say. Fortune intends to drive me to distraction. But I mustn't blame Fortune. I am myself the cause of all my misery. Partridge, see if you can find my mother and bring her back to talk with me. A few minutes ago the sky seemed to lighten, now it is darker than ever.
Mr. Allworthy sits alone in his lodgings at Mrs. Miller's, filled with a great sense of sorrow.
How are you, sir?
I do not know how long I have been sitting here.
Well, perhaps I bring you good news. I have been making inquiries about the witnesses to this wretched duel. I found the fellows who were prepared to swear blind that Mr. Jones struck the first blow. But learning the case had taken a less desperate turn, for a few pence, they confessed they had been suborned to swear this by somebody who saw my Tom as a rival for Miss Sophia's hand. And the witnesses admitted it was a very different story from the one they told the lawyer.
The lawyer?
Your lawyer.
Mr. Dowling?
Yes.
Well, these days he's not so much my lawyer as my nephew's, who seems now to give him work at every opportunity. Mrs. Miller, will you ask my nephew to come and see me?
The day of judgment, it seems, is fast approaching. But who is going to be judged and found wanting is still far from clear.
You wanted to see me, Uncle?
Yes. Lawyer Dowling.
What of him?
You seem very thick with him of late.
He's been doing some work for me, yes.
So, did you ask him to go and see any of the persons who were present at the duel between Tom and the other gentleman? Why do you hesitate, sir?
I have been guilty of an offence, but I hope I can have your pardon.
A pardon for what?
I did send Mr. Dowling to discover the witnesses, to endeavour to soften their evidence. This is the truth, although I cannot deny I tried to conceal it from you.
You have done well, nephew.
Thank you, Uncle.
In fact, I will follow your example and be more forgiving myself. Shall we take a hackney coach and go together and pay a visit to poor, unfortunate Tom? Mrs. Miller has been so eloquent on his good nature and, well, I own I cannot stop myself feeling concerned for his wretched state. You'll come with me to the prison?
Uncle, I'm not sure that I'm ready for such a journey, so I beg you...
Mr. Allworthy! Where is he? I must see him! Alone!
Nephew, leave me, please.
And so Mr. Blifil retires, and an anxious Partridge is shown in.
Mr. Allworthy!
Partridge!
You recognise me, sir? After all these years? It's about Mr. Jones. I need to talk to you.
You are the servant of his I've heard about from Mrs. Miller.
I am. But about Mr. Jones...
Surely, friend, you are the strangest of all human beings. Partridge, what can have possessed you to pass yourself off to the world as the servant of your own son? Or what can be your motive?
Your Honour, pardon me. There is not much time. It is only recently that I met up again with my son, as you are pleased to call him. But upon my most solemn oath, I am no more the father of Jones and the Pope of Rome.
Why should you so strongly deny a fact which I think would be rather in your interest to own?
I only wish you had mistaken the mother of this young man as well as you had the father.
What are you talking about?
I don't know how to tell you, but Jenny Jones is worse, and Thomas, is too terrible. And Jenny...
Where is Mr. Allworthy? I have to see him.
And immediately the door opens and in walks...
Jenny Jones!
Tom's unfortunate mother.
Mr. Allworthy, it's a long time since I have had the honour of seeing you.
But why are you here? Do you have some particular business with me?
Business of the utmost importance, and I must therefore ask the favour of a word with you, alone.
Partridge, leave us, please.
Sir, madam.
So, say what you have to say, Jenny Jones.
You must recollect when we were all so much younger, a fellow called Summer.
Indeed. He was the son of a clergyman of great learning and virtue for whom I had the highest friendship. When he finished his studies, he came to stay with us, a man of wit and good breeding.
And handsome, too.
Oh, I'm sorry, he died untimely of the smallpox. Little did I think he had sins like this to answer for I plainly see you're going to tell me he is the father of your child.
No, he is not, but he is the father of this child.
Why, you contradict yourself.
The father of Tom, but not by me. I am not his mother, for which we at this moment must be heartily thankful.
Well, you confessed it all in front of me.
What I confessed was true to this extent. I was the person who conveyed the infant to your bed at the command of its mother. And afterwards I owned it mine, and thought myself by her considerable generosity nobly rewarded both my secrecy and my shame.
So, Tom's mother was...
Your sister. Bridget.
It cannot be. It cannot.
You had been away for so long at that time. Her condition only became clear after your departure, and only my mother and I were privy to the secret birth which took place in our house.
Did she leave no proof? Oh, it was wrong of her to carry the secret with her out of the world.
She didn't.
Yeah, but she...
Below is a gentleman who I have reluctantly made to agree to tell the truth. Mr. Blifil tried to pay for his silence, but he realizes the game is up. He is, of course...
Lawyer Dowling.
Remember, I told you he is important.
Now, Mr. Dowling, tell us what you know, and none of your lawyer's tricks.
I have always believed there was an appropriate moment to tell what I know.
When you decided which side your bread was buttered on, you mean?
I was at the bedside of your sister, Mrs. Bridget Allworthy, during her final illness. In fact, I was probably the last person to see her alive. She gave me a letter, the letter I brought your worship from Salisbury.
I know of no such letter. What did it say?
I can only guess. As she was dying, she said to me, "I scarce know what I have written. Tell my brother, Mr. Jones is his nephew. He is my son, bless him." She never spoke more and died a few minutes afterwards.
Well, why did you not give me her letter?
You were very ill at the time, and so I gave the letter and message to Mr. Blifil, who promised he would carry both of them to you.
He did what?
Uncle, why are all these people here? What's happening?
Well, I am going to see Mr. Jones, Tom, in prison, as I had intended.
I'm sorry, I can't. I feel a little indisposed.
Well, in that case, before my return, perhaps you can find out the letter which your mother sent me on her deathbed.
Uncle? No, I can't. What letter? Mother never sent me...
Allworthy and the assembled company depart soon after, leaving Mr. Blifil in a situation... only to be envied by a man who's just going to be hanged. And so to prison.
Oh, Thomas!
It can't be. My benefactor.
Oh, more, Tom! Your uncle!
And then Mr. Allworthy tells Tom all that has already been told you. And Tom's delight can be imagined. To know that his supposed mother is not his mother gives him almost as much pleasure as to learn who his true mother was.
Would the heavens seem at last to have blessed me beyond my worth? I already had word that Mr. Fitzpatrick is fully recovered and has exonerated me, so I am free to leave. But believe me, that is nothing to seeing you again, my uncle.
Child, I have used you cruelly.
You? Never. I feel I have not been punished more than I deserved. Though I don't charge myself with any gross villainy, yet I know I have enough follies and vices to repent and be ashamed of. But as for my half-brother, I feel sorry for him.
Don't carry your forgiving temper too far. He shall not lack for money to survive on, although I am determined never to see his face again.
But...
No buts, Tom.
There is, of course... only one deep regret I have. And again, it is the result of my own folly.
I understand. The loss of Sophia.
Tom, my old friend, how are you?
Squire Weston.
I wanted you to know how delighted I am at your release from prison and the news about you and your uncle. For once, my sister and I are agreed. The past must be forgotten. Forget the hasty words that have been spoken. Call off the chase.
But I cannot believe Sophia feels as you do.
Oh, come. She's a delicious little creature. We are all agreed.
Oh, yes.
You shall have the tousling of her.
And so, after all their adventures and vicissitudes, our hero and our heroine are sitting alone together.
Of course I am pleased to hear of your changed circumstances. But I leave it to yourself to pass sentence on your own conduct towards me.
Is there then no forgiveness? I have explained the reasons for my letter proposing marriage to Lady Bellaston.
And I accept your explanation. But then there is the matter of the inn at Upton. What happiness can I assure myself with a man capable of such inconstancy?
I admit my faults. Believe me, no repentance was ever so sincere.
Time and time alone will convince me you are a true penitent. If I am to judge of the future by the past, when I am out of your sight, then I will be out of your mind.
You were never out of my mind. The delicacy of your sex cannot conceive the grossness of ours, nor how little one sort of amour has to do with the heart.
I will never marry a man who is not as incapable as I am of making such a distinction. Time, as I said, will tell.
But how much time?
That is not for you to ask.
At least give me some idea.
A 12-month, perhaps.
You have named an eternity.
It may be sooner. I will not be teased. It's up to you. To your behaviour, I mean.
Oh, my dear angel. You give me hope. Let me kiss you.
Mr. Jones, I...
To her, boy! To her! That's my little honeys. Has she appointed the day? Shall it be tomorrow or the next day? She'd have the wedding tonight with all her heart, wouldn't you, Sophie?
You appear to know my thoughts better than I do, Father.
That's my Thomas Wilder.
And so our hero and heroine are finally married. And as befits a responsible narrator, I would like to assure you that all the characters named received appropriate rewards or punishments for their part in this narrative. As for the wedding night, I leave you to imagine it for yourselves. And if you don't wish to imagine it, then that really is your problem.
In the final part of Tom Jones, dramatised by Stephen Wyatt, Tom was played by Michael Legg, Henry Fielding by Simon Russell Beale, Mr. Allworthy by James Lawrenson, Squire Weston by Trevor Peacock, Blifil by Adrian Scarborough, Partridge by Charles Barnicot, and Dowling by Sam Dale. Sophia was played by Claire Corbett, Miss Weston by Margaret Tysack, Jenny Jones by Rachel Babbage, Lady Bellaston by Christine Kavanagh, and Harriet by Liza Sadovy. The director was Claire Grove.
And tomorrow, Juliet Stevenson stars in Jane Austen's last complete novel, Persuasion. Anne Elliot meets her fiancé, Frederick Wentworth, again after 8 years apart. Join their reunion tomorrow at the same time. This month heralds the 75th anniversary of the first broadcast of a radio comedy that became a popular staple of the war years. ITMAR, or to give it its full name, It's That Man Again. On Sunday on 4 Extra, that man, Tommy Handley and his team, will be putting on a sterling show of nitwittery and noise in an episode that hasn't been broadcast since it originally aired on the Home Service back in 1940, and when methods of communication somewhat differed to now.
I went in the post office the other day, and while I was in there, a fellow went up and asked the girl for a telegram form. And she gave him a telegram form, and he wrote on it, diddle, 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 diddle. Mm-hmm. So the girl looked at it, she said, you can have another word for the same money. She said, shall I put another diddle in? He said, no, that'll make it look silly.
Hear ITMAR on Sunday morning at 8, 3 in the afternoon, and again in the evening at 8. Diddle.
BBC Radio 4 Extra celebrates the work of Geoffrey Perkins.
Where are we going?
How should I know? It's your universe. You go where you like.
The Advertising Double Standards Authority. You'll believe a man can lie.
Where have you been?
Oh, beg pardon. Permission to come aboard, Captain.
The death rate is remaining steady at one per person.
Angus Deaton looks back at some rare radio gems produced by his friend and colleague.
A toast then to, as he might have said himself, the man without whom this show would not have been possible, and with whom the show would have been slightly weird. The man they called Mr. Comedy, Geoffrey Comedy.
The Workings of Perkins. Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 11 o'clock. Hello, I'm Zeb Soames. And in 15 minutes, Anton Rogers stars in a bittersweet drama about it.